afternoon. This is the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is Tuesday, June 10th, 2025. Welcome to our afternoon program. Your readers are
Mary Cirillo.
And I'm Leon Whitehead. Mary and I will be reading selections from the sports section of today's News and Observer, Chatham News and Record, Courier Times, Washington Daily, Kinston Free Press, Jacksonville Daily, Greensboro News and Record, and Winston-Salem Journal. All articles are read exactly as printed, and the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's noon broadcast is generously underwritten by Christine and Greg Tenser. At 1:30, it's Money Matters, but we'll start with sports. And, well, if you've been following college baseball and the road to Omaha, Carolina managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory on Sunday, and Omaha just remains just out of reach for Duke. A late-game collapse spelled disaster for the Blue Devils and a 5-4 loss to Murray State in Monday's winner-take-all game of the NCAA Durham Super Regional. The Racers spoiled Duke's College World Series hopes on Jack Coombs Field, clinching a spot in Omaha for the first time. Duke carried a 3-2 lead into the seventh inning, but the Racers tied the game when Jonathan Hogarth belted his second home run of the game in the top of the seventh. Murray State then took the lead for good with two more runs in the top of the eighth and held on, preventing Duke from making its first College World Series appearance since 1961. The teams combined for six home runs, and it was Luke Mistone's tie-breaking homer in the top of the eighth that pushed the Racers over the edge. Murray State, 44-15 on the season, is the fourth number four seed to ever advance to the Men's College World Series and the first Missouri Valley Conference team to reach Omaha since 2003. Duke's final home run in the bottom of the eighth wasn't enough to save the Blue Devils' season, and their 64-year Omaha drought continues. In similar fashion to Sunday's game, Hogarth cranked a leadoff home run over the left field wall. Carson Garner followed it with a double, and Dom Decker to bat him in with a single up the middle. The Racers loaded the bases, stringing together five hits. Freshman starting pitcher Henry Zatkowski escaped the inning with the Blue Devils trailing 2-0. Zatkowski recovered, collected a career-high seven strikeouts in four innings. Duke punched back in the bottom of the first. First baseman Jake Hyde hit a sacrifice fly to right field to score shortstop Wallace Clark, who drew a leadoff walk and advanced to second on a single from A.J. Gracia. Hyde followed with a home run to center field in the third to knot the game at 2-2. Then second baseman Jake Berger, who entered Monday going 0-for-5 with two walks in the Super Regionals, led off the fourth inning with a home run, soaring just 3 feet over the center field wall to give Duke its first lead of the night, 3-2. After five scoreless innings that saw only one hit from the Racers, Hogarth tied it back up with another home run at the top of the seventh, nailing a ball 413 feet over the left field fence. Mistone rocketed another long ball to the same spot, retaking the lead from Murray State in the top of the eighth. Then Dan Talkins' RBI triple pushed the Racers' lead to 5-3. In the bottom of the inning, Duke sophomore catcher Macon Winslow sent the sixth home run of the night to left field with two outs to pull the Blue Devils within one. Duke had life in the bottom of the ninth when Clark was hit by an inside breaking ball with nobody out. After Gracia fell out, the Blue Devil season nearly ended on a rare runner's interference call for an illegal slide into second on what could have been a double play off the bat of Ben Miller. The Racers even stormed the field in celebration. But officials overturned the call. Clark was still out at second, but Miller was safe at first. Duke pinch runner ran for Miller, but the Racers reset, and Graham Kellum got Hyde to ground out to first to end the game. The fourth time in the past seven seasons, the Blue Devil season ended in a Super Regional. So it's on to Omaha, and the first game is Friday, this coming Friday. I don't remember who's playing. I think it may be Coastal Carolina, the team from Conway, South Carolina. Not sure who they're playing, but Men's College World Series begins on Friday.
All right. Duke's Blue Devils will open the 2025-26 men's basketball season in first Dick Vitale Invitational. It was announced Monday on the longtime ESPN broadcaster's 86th birthday. The Blue Devils will face the Texas Longhorns on November 4th at Charlotte's Spectrum Center. The announcement was made jointly by ESPN Events and Charlotte Sports Foundation. Tip-off time for the event to be shown on ESPN will be announced at a later date. ESPN has been such a vital part of my life since December 5, 1979, and I was so thrilled to learn that ESPN Events will have an annual Dick Vitale Invitational. Vitale said in a statement, ESPN has been family to me and has given me a life that has been even better than my dreams. Since joining ESPN during its first year in 1979, Vitale has called more than 1,000 games. His passion for the game helped shape the college basketball experience for fans far more than four decades, while cementing a legacy as one of the most enduring figures in sports broadcasting history. Vitale has been inducted into the Nesmith Basketball and Sports Broadcasting Halls of Fame. Most recently, he received the Dean Smith Award from the U.S. Basketball Writers Association, or USBWA, as well as the New York Athletic Club Winged Foot Award. For over 30 years, he has been the voice of college basketball, Clint Overby, vice president of ESPN Events, said in a statement. I can't think of a better way to honor his legacy than have a basketball event featuring the very best of the sport. Game information can be obtained. The Blue Devils and Longhorns have played five times and have all been Duke victories since 2000. In the most recent game, the Blue Devils took an 85-78 overtime win in Portland, Oregon, on November 24, 2017. The Texas matchup adds to a non-conference schedule that sees Duke playing a number of fellow Power Conference opponents in John Shire's fourth season as head coach. Duke also plays Kansas on November 18th at New York's Madison Square Garden as part of the Champions Classic doubleheader. On Thanksgiving night, November 27th, Duke will play Arkansas at Chicago's United Center. The following week, the Blue Devils will take part on the ACC-SEC Challenge against an opponent to be determined. Duke and Michigan State are close to finalizing an agreement to play each other in East Lansing, Michigan, possibly this December. The Blue Devils are also in discussion to play Michigan on a neutral court in Washington, D.C. in February. The ACC cut its league schedule by two games this season, freeing up schools to add two additional non-conference games. Duke's ACC slate includes home games with UNC, Louisville, Boston College, Clemson, Georgia Tech, SMU, Syracuse, Virginia, and Wake Forest. The Blue Devils league road schedule has them playing at UNC, Louisville, California, Florida State, NC State, Notre Dame, Pitt, Stanford, and Virginia Tech. For game information, Dick Vitale Invitational, go to DickVitaleInvitational.com.
And finally in sports, got a little Panthers football news here. The Carolina Panthers youth movement is in full effect entering this week's mandatory minicamp. The team has brought in a host of youthful upgrades from free agency to the draft to improve the roster for the next few years. And as general manager Dan Morgan and head coach Dave Canales continue to build the depth chart in their image, the bulk of the returning players are set to enter the final year on their respective contracts. The Panthers have just 9 players who are age 30 or older entering mandatory minicamp. Of that group, 6 of the 30-plus crowd will test free agency in 2026 once their contracts expire. So here are the 16 notable Panthers players set for free agency next year. Right tackle Taylor Moten, who's 30, will count as $31.3 million on the Panthers' salary cap this season. While he's making a respectable $14.3 million base salary, multiple contract restructures have attached significant weight, read dead money, on his cap number this year. Panthers have had the option of lowering that cap number with the contract extension, but the team has chosen to be patient and take the hit for now. Moten has been the team's most consistent lineman for several years. While he's dealt with some minor injuries recently, he's still been pretty reliable on the field. It'll be interesting to see how the team handles this situation if Moten thrives during the 2025 campaign. Wide receiver Adam Thielen was given a unique pay bump to stick around in 2025. The 34-year-old wideout has led the team in receiving over the past 2 years and has been Bryce Young's steadiest target during his Carolina tenure. With all that said, the team has invested quite a bit of draft capital to prepare for Thielen's eventual retirement. Thielen's targets are likely to see a drop-off in his third year with the franchise. The team has spent back-to-back first-round picks on wideouts Teora McMillan and Xavier Leggett, and the team feels good about young contributors like Jimmy Horn, Jr., and Jalen Coker. This is likely to be Thielen's last rodeo, even if that just means he'll leave Carolina for a contender. Outside linebacker D.J. Wonnum, with Jadeveon Clowney no longer in Carolina, Wonnum will need to step up in his second year with the Panthers. The South Carolina alum produced 4 sacks in 8 games last season after returning from an injury saga that included multiple surgeries and a blood clot. While he continues to deal with a minor back injury, the 27-year-old pass rusher has a much better outlook than he did last summer, and he should be able to work throughout the majority of training camp to prepare for the season. Wonnum should get every opportunity to be a starter this season. While he isn't a particularly consistent run stopper, he has proven he's the best pass rusher within outside linebacker room. Despite that status, second-round pick Nick Scorton and third-round pick Princely Yemanimalin could eat into his snaps rather quickly. Center Austin Corbett signed a 1-year deal to return to Carolina and compete for the starting center job. While he isn't guaranteed a starting spot, he does have a fully guaranteed base salary. 29-year-old lineman should be considered the favorite at the top gig, but he'll face worthwhile competition from Cade Mays, who is also a 1-year deal. The key for Corbett will be staying healthy. When he's been on the field, he's been terrific. However, he's played in just 9 games over the past 2 seasons due to a trio of surgeries. He can remain durable and play well, could get another deal in Carolina. Center Cade Mays, like Corbett, is on a 1-year pact to compete. Mays filled in admirably at center during the second half of last season, and he's only 26. If Mays can win the job outright, the Panthers might have a reasonable trade chip in Corbett. However, if Mays loses the competition, he faces a tough outlook. His restricted tender isn't guaranteed, and the Panthers saved $3.4 million by releasing him. Guard tackle Brady Christensen, 28, surprisingly re-signed with the Panthers this offseason, capable of playing all 5 positions on the offensive line. Christensen is ample insurance for the team's most prized unit. He also gives the Panthers roster options based on how the starting center battle plays out, as he can back up Corbett or Mays if the team decides to move on from the runner-up. Defensive tackle Shai Tuttle, the starting nose tackle for the past 2 seasons, could take a pay cut to stick around in 2025. After 2 mediocre years as a starter, the Panthers are hoping he can be an impactful depth piece. The team has upgraded the position offseason by signing Bobby Brown III and drafting Cam Jackson. Tuttle, 29, will need to beat out second-year lineman Jaden Crumity, journeyman Sam Roberts, and others to hold on to the job this summer. Wide receiver Hunter Renfrow, 29, signed a 1-year deal with the Panthers in April. The former Pro Bowl wideout took last year off to deal with an illness, but he's looking to recapture his career trajectory now that he's recovered. He's expected to compete with the likes of David Moore, Dan Shinsei, Jacoby George, Kobe Hudson, and others for a spot on the roster. And we're running out of time. I will do one more. Wide receiver David Moore, who's 30, was a bit of an unsung hero for the Panthers offense last season. While he isn't likely to be more than a depth option this year, Canales has often praised his leadership and knowledge of the offense. Moore is also a quality special teams asset, and his ability to work in multiple phases might be his ace in the hole to making the roster. And unfortunately, we won't be able to go through the last of the folks on that list, but it's time to move on now to the Chatham News and Record. Mary?
Park Ranger Jesse Anderson leads dozens of people on a weekly hike in North Carolina to see some of the most unique living plants in the world. Plants that supplement the nutrients they get from sunlight by digesting ants, flies, and spiders. But the Venus flytraps aren't like the human-sized ravenous and cruel Audrey in Little Shop of Horrors. In the world, Venus flytraps are the size of a lima bean and pose no harm to anything other than insects. Their special hairs snap their leaves together when brushed, but only twice in about 20 seconds or less to reduce the amount of false alarms by dust or rain. Once inside, the insect is doomed to become plant food, Anderson said. It continues to trigger those hairs, and the trap slowly closes and eventually starts releasing digestive enzymes to start breaking down the insect. And because they're in nutrient-poor environments, they supplement their food with insects, Anderson said. Anderson's hike at Carolina Beach State Park on the southeast North Carolina coast also showcases other carnivorous plants. There are vase-shaped pitcher plants with liquid at the bottom that traps insects, then digests them. Butterworts and sundews attract insects with glistening leaves, then secrete an adhesive to trap them in place. Bladderworts work similarly to Venus flytraps, and the hike is one of the few places to see Venus flytraps. The plant only grows in 12 counties in southeast North Carolina, near Wilmington, and a few nearby places in South Carolina, which made the organism the state's official carnivorous plant in 2023. Now is an especially good time to take that hike. Venus flytraps bloom from about mid-May to mid-June, Anderson said. The flytrap is a fragile plant that needs fire to survive. Wildfires in the pine forests where they grow clear off the denser overgrowth to provide the abundant sunlight the plants need. They face two big enemies, poachers and development. Harvesting the plants without permission is a felony in North Carolina and a misdemeanor in South Carolina. In 2016, a man was sentenced to 17 months in prison for taking nearly 1,000 Venus flytraps from game land in Hampstead. And the flytraps live in one of the fastest-growing parts of the U.S., where neighborhoods and businesses have been built over their habitats. Most of the plants can now be found in preserves and other undisturbed areas. Scientists counted only about 300,000 flytraps in the Carolinas several years ago. While Anderson's hike is one of the few ways to see Venus flytraps in their natural environment, he said commercially grown plants can be found around in greenhouses and plant stores around the world and can thrive in homes in the right conditions. They like nutrient-poor soils, and also they can't stand typical well water or tap water, so they need things like rainwater or distilled water or versus osmosis, Anderson said. Versus osmosis. Venus flytraps need abundant sunlight and soils that are moist but not drenched, and they don't have to eat bugs if they can get enough nutrients from photosynthesis. Please don't feed them hamburger meat. That's not what they eat. And try not to trigger the leaves shut with something to digest. That takes a lot of energy that the plant needs to replace.
They're lovely to look at, but leave them alone.
Right, although I'd like to get them from my yard, just on my table outside.
Well, Chatham County Schools is introducing a new scholarship program to aid in future teacher recruitment. At its June 2nd regular business meeting, the Chatham County Schools Board of Education approved the Teach Chatham Scholarship, up to $10,000 award for students interested in teaching back in Chatham County following their post-secondary education. Teach Chatham is a grassroots, grow-your-own teacher program right here for Chatham County Schools, said Executive Director Michelle Burton. The goal is to provide students who are interested in becoming educators an opportunity to begin coursework while they're still in high school, as well as to participate in a number of educational career-building opportunities throughout the district and even now the full community of Chatham. Scholarships can be up to $10,000 with the funds awarded by the Chatham Education Foundation. As a pass-through, students would be eligible for $2,500 each year for 4 years. Those receiving scholarship funds would be required to return to Chatham County and teach for 4 years. This is in an effort to attract our students starting in 10th grade to have an interest in becoming future teachers and educators, said Assistant Superintendent Amanda Moran. We want to bring these students back home to teach here in Chatham County. The inaugural recipients of the scholarship, Kelly Fogelman from Jordan Matthews High School and Kyle Stinson from Seaforth High, were also announced at the meeting. The board also recognized Moran as being the North Carolina Association School Administrators 2025 Administrator of the Year. The statewide honor recognizes exceptional leadership, vision, and commitment to student enrichment through academic competition and co-current curricular program. Dr. Moran's visionary leadership and deep belief in the power of academic competition have helped shape a culture where students are encouraged to challenge themselves and grow, said Superintendent Anthony Jackson. We are thrilled to see her outstanding contribution recognized at the state level.
Okay, and this is a column by Andrew Taylor Troutman, the pastor of Chapel in the Pines Presbyterian Church, and who is also a contributor to the paper. Congratulations, you've navigated middle school. Who said you wouldn't make it out alive? Of course, your experiences are as vastly diverse as each of you, yet you have come a long way on the journey and learned many things, including life lessons like the importance of deodorant. I'm particularly glad for this lesson if you happen to ride in my car. You have spent the last year on top of the student body pyramid. Now, as you prepare to enter high school, you find yourselves once again on the bottom. I know a teacher who taught high school for 4 decades. She said that the secret to high school is really as simple as having one trustworthy friend. Oh, things like organizational habits and study skills are important. Extracurriculars, community service, and volunteer opportunities build character. For heaven's sake, get a good night's sleep. But she maintained that your one friend makes all the difference. This is not to imply that you can't be friendly with different folks. Maybe you'll join a team or a club and meet lots of good people. Perhaps you'll sit with a dozen students in the cafeteria and enjoy the time together. Yet you will face lots of peer pressure about what to do and not to do. Some pressure will be positive and some of it will be negative. Most of it will be inconsequential. The clothes you wear or the music you like doesn't really matter. Trust me, it will change. But even at your relatively young age, you may face a situation that could impact your long-term future. Who will you trust to help you make that decision? It's a gift to have elder mentors like parents, pastors, and coaches to provide guidance. You will also listen to your trusted friend. Will that person have your best interests in mind? Apart from making major decisions, a true friend will also allow you to be your true self. What a relief to stop pretending, promoting, and performing. You need someone who doesn't judge you for being you, but actually likes the real you. This kind of friend is crucial at any stage in life. Maybe someday you'll even marry such a person. For now, though, just remember that as you rise up and move on, many things will change in the next 4 years, and that's as it should be. But if you can, hold on to that best friend.
And finally, from the News and Record, here's Bob Walk's column entitled Lessons in and of Life Take Years to Learn. A significant event came my way this week. No, it wasn't the lottery or last house payment, or even a note from an old girlfriend, Catherine Kitty Litter, saying she finally realized she missed the boat all those years ago. Instead, it was the annual celebration of some of my mama's finest work, notably the day she brought me into the world. I won't mention the year this event came about or how many years it's been, but simply say it was before Ike came into the White House. But I'll go on record, however, saying as I can't believe how quickly it got here. It's been a while coming, and there's been a fair amount of water over the dam and under the bridge. But I'm also glad the water continues flowing, and I hope it will for some time. Looking back over those years, it doesn't seem so long ago. People, place, and events come to mind, and I wonder where they all are now. Our little family came to Pittsboro when I was a wee, handsome, well, at least we, little lad of 5. My dad had changed careers, and Chatham County was home to him and Mama anyway. Had that not happened, I would have grown up in Apex and never gotten acquainted with Bondly or Harper's Crossroads or Rufus's Restaurant and hundreds of wonderful folks. My school days would have been spent in Wake County instead of the halls of Pittsboro High School, where I managed to get thrown out of school assembly my senior year when I was student body president and fouled out of a junior varsity basketball game during the warm-ups when I was in the ninth grade. I think back on those growing up days, remembering who dated who and who had what car, the words to every rock and roll song WKIX played, and many other important pieces of information. However, I could not then, and still cannot now, tell you the words to the French national anthem, how many bones a frog has in its body, or how to find the square root of 147, all of which various teachers deemed essential at the time. Instead, I think of the 20 or so classmates who are now precious memories, ditto for the class ahead of me and behind me. Same thing happened with my college career, the one where I managed to cram a four-year course of study into seven. I knew I was going to Chapel Hill to get an education. I just didn't think it would all be on campus, and it wasn't. These days, I remember the guys in my dorm, Chester, Chuck, Connor, who combined brains, books, and looks into one great all-around guy, Sam, Froggy Greathouse, who got us into trouble with the dean because we hung out the second-story windows making pig grunt noises at the female students as they walked by, and is now one of those aforementioned memories, Ronald and Donald Green, the twins from Carthage, who I never could tell apart and still couldn't a few years ago when I bumped into them at a funeral service I conducted for a family member of a mutual friend, and numerous others whose faces come to mind but don't bring names with them. There are other highlights, many in fact, a career in community journalism, which led me to meet my better, much better half when we worked together beside each other in adjoining buildings in Pittsboro one summer, the wonderful days of courtship when I stopped running so she could catch me, the years since then when our two 40-plus-something who were teenagers who lived at my house and have now produced their own set of humans, some of whom are teenagers and others who soon will be and live at their houses. But for right now, they are without a doubt the most wonderful grandchildren the world has ever seen. And there are others, a job that once let me work with farmers and rural folks all over two Carolinas, a seminary course of study that produced a change in careers and the subsequent places of service and even an opportunity to combine journalism and ministry as a life's work for several years. One time I thought I'd retire. Now I know there's not enough time to do that. And maybe the best lesson is that it has come to the best lesson that has come from these yearly celebrations. I know I'm not the only person who has such momentous occasions. My hope through the years of turning out these columns is that maybe once in a while, if you're brave enough to read them, we all share the human condition known as life, and that birthdays are another opportunity to get on with living it. Hope yours is happy and prosperous whenever it is and however many there are. And that's Bob Walks, and that's it for the Chatham News and Record. We'll go now to the Courier Times. Mary?
In his closing comments on Monday's meeting of the Person County Board of Commissioners, Chair Kyle Puryear requested county staff expedite a meeting with the mother of a one-year-old, Kemari Morgan, who died in a local foster home Saturday, May 24th. Puryear said he would like to expedite a meeting with Brianna Morgan, Kemari's mother, and requested Commissioner Antoinette Royster participate. Royster is herself a former social worker for the County Department of Social Services. During Monday night's meeting, eight speakers, including Morgan and the child's great-grandmother, Sheila Chris, spoke to the board asking for policy changes and for the commissioners to return Morgan's other child, Zariah, who is still in the county's Department of Social Services care. I know it's hard to imagine what I'm going through. Most people will never have to feel this kind of pain, but I'm asking that you try, Morgan said Monday. Imagine being at work just another day when your phone rings and on the other end someone tells you that your baby, your sweet, innocent one-year-old son is gone, that you will never see him again. That was my reality when my son, Kemari Morgan, died while in the custody of Person County, and to this day I don't have answers. This is not just about grief. This is about justice. It's about a system that tore my family apart in my darkest moments. I am here today to say enough is enough. I'm demanding that my daughter, Zariah, come home. I know that the commissioners in this county have the power to oversee social services. You govern them. You are responsible for their decisions, and I'm asking that you do what's right bring Zariah home, give my family the chance to grieve together, to heal together, to survive this tragedy with some dignity. You have the power. Please do the right thing. Sheila Chris, Brianna's grandmother and great-grandmother to Kamari and Zariah, echoed Morgan. My heart is breaking for my granddaughter and my family for everything we have been forced to endure. I'm trying to be strong for my granddaughter and for the children we are fighting for, but the truth is this pain is unbearable. This agency has moved on to the next file, the next case, but we can't move on. We are still here grieving and broken and trying to pick up the pieces of a family that's been shattered. Tonight, my granddaughter should be able to hold her child. She should not have to go to bed wondering if Zariah is okay. We are calling on you, the commissioners, to do what is right to oversee this agency. You have the authority to intervene, and today I'm asking you to use your power to return Zariah to her family. During her comments near the end of Monday's meeting, Royster sympathized with Morgan's family but said the commissioners cannot make the decision on a child's custody. When children are removed, the judge makes that call, and for them to return home, and this is policy, a judge has to make that call, Royster said. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm just going to speak from my heart now and will probably be unprofessional as a commissioner. There are many times I disagreed with the judge and I had to be called to the back so they could explain to me why the decision was made. I don't know your case. I'm not here as a social worker or a state representative or a state program consultant. That's my day job. I can't staff your case. I don't know the ins and outs of your case. But what I will encourage you to do is ask the questions. You have that right. Ask the questions, follow whatever plan they have. Again, I don't know your case, but we can't as a board override the judge. In a statement opening Monday's meeting, County Manager Catherine Cathy said county government is accountable to the community and values transparency, but there is an ongoing review of the situation by the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. The Person County Board of Commissioners voted to oversee the newly created DSS and Veterans Service Office Consolidated Human Service Agency in January 2024, eliminating the county's previous DSS board. In the last week, the Person County Sheriff's Office has responded to reports of trespassing and protests at DSS Director Carlton Paler's home in the wake of Morgan's death. According to reports released by the Sheriff's Office, deputies were dispatched Thursday and Sunday to Paler's home, where items had been placed on Paler's property by members of Operation Stop CPS, and a protest had formed. On Sunday, when deputies arrived around 5:30 p.m., they gave the protesters 10 minutes to disperse before further action was taken. According to the report, the crowd dispersed and the protesters were mostly peaceful, and no deputies used any force on the scene. On Monday, Amanda Wallace of Greensboro, who identified herself as a member of Operation Stop CPS during the board meeting, was taken into custody for misdemeanor second-degree trespassing on Paler's property Thursday. Wallace was placed under a $500 bond and posted bond on Tuesday.
This article is very lengthy, and we will not have time to read the entire article, so it will be edited for content. But with a unanimous vote last Monday night, the Person County Board of Commissioners elected Donald Long to fill the opening created by Commissioner Tracy Ellickson's May 5th resignation. Long will serve until December of 2026. The timing of Ellickson's resignation will require a special election to fill the second half of the four-year term. In the November 2026 election, there will now be a race between Democratic and Republican nominees for the remainder of Ellickson's term through December of 2028. Long was selected over three nominees from the Person County Republican Party. North Carolina general statutes dictate the person to fill the vacant seat must be a registered Republican, as Ellickson was, the party's nominee following last year's primary. State law says the commissioners were required to consult the executive committee of the county Republican Party before filling the vacancy, but the board was not required to appoint the committee's recommendation. Long currently serves on the county's Public Economic Development Commission, where he has previously been the board's vice chair and is currently vice chair of the Person County Business and Industrial Center private nonprofit. Long is currently a member of the county's Recreation Advisory Board and has served on the county's Department of Social Services Board. He ran unsuccessfully for the seat on the Board of Commissioners in 2014 and 2016 as a Democrat. Long said his switch to the Republican Party came when he found himself in a changing organization with no room or tolerance for constitutional conservatives like myself. Long said he believes in transparency in government, but often elected and non-elected officials are required to sign non-disclosure agreements in which they are bound by law not to divulge certain information in certain situations, especially in economic development-related matters. I have nothing to hide. When it's proper to discuss such topics, I'll gladly do so, but until the non-disclosure agreement is lifted by law, I would be unable to discuss it, Long said. I'm only human, fallible, and imperfect. I can promise you, like each of you, I will make mistakes. But let us speak kindly to one another and respect differences of opinion. Seek to foster better ideas and better government, but let us do this in a kind and tender manner. Let us join as one. We are all citizens of Person County. Let us stand together with courage and honest principles toward one another, recognizing one's viewpoint often changes based on where one sits. We all have an obligation to think bigger and cast a wider net. These corporations we are asking to come to Person County and make large investments provide many, many jobs and pay property taxes, so our individual tax burden will be lower. They are all looking and reading what's posted on social media about Person County and their leadership. If you were the CEO of a large company, what type of community would you be looking to locate? If we would all just talk to one another instead of talking about one another, much could be accomplished. Professionally, Long previously worked for Lock Screen Company, Incorporated, and now owns and operates Long Incorporated, which provides services in asphalt paving and maintenance, concrete installation, roll-off container services, demolition services, parking lot striping and seal coating, dump truck contract hauling, as well as property management, wastewater systems management, and stormwater maintenance. Mary?
Okay, and this is the column from the Chief's Corner, Chief of Police David Hess. Living in a safe community is a testament to community partnerships and support of public safety. With historic low crime rates over the last decade, Roxborough twice earned recognition as one of the top 100 safest cities in North Carolina. But with that sense of community safety comes the risk of complacency. Roxborough is not the same little town it was 20 or 30 years ago. Gone are the days you can leave your home or your car unlocked. We have some in society who do not possess the same values as the majority. The lack of respect for someone's property is a cherished ideal of yesterday. Why write about this topic? In recent years, the number one contributor to stolen firearms is leaving them in unlocked cars. Let's be real for a minute. Seriously, people? One, never a good idea to leave your car unlocked. Secondly, definitely not a good idea to leave your car unlocked with valuables like guns or keys, wallets, and other items inside the vehicle. Last month, our department investigated a rash of vehicle breaking and enterings throughout the city. All, every single one of them, the car was unlocked. Several guns were stolen from unlocked cars that will now be used in violent crimes in our community. Not good. As a gun owner, you have a responsibility to secure your gun. If you have juveniles in your home, state law requires you to secure your firearm where it is not accessible to juveniles. Guess who the offenders were in the crime spree where guns were stolen? Juveniles. In 2023, we published a concerning upward crime trend in juvenile crimes, particularly violent crimes involving firearms. A lot of time was invested in resources and partnerships to combat violent crime and youth offenses. That hard work produced a 55% reduction last year in juvenile crime. As citizens, you play a vital role in keeping crime rates low. Your willingness to see something, say something, and report suspicious activity provides tips and leads for us to help deter crime and make arrests. In that space, we need your help. Stop leaving guns in cars. Stop leaving your car unlocked. We offer free gun locks at the police department to the community. So if you do not have a way to secure your firearm inside your home, we can provide you a free gun lock to keep your gun secure. Your decision to leave a gun in an unlocked car places your family, friends, and the community at risk of violent crime or worse, a homicide. Remove it, lock it, keep it. Sanctity of life is everyone's responsibility. Let's all work together to keep Roxborough and Person County a safe place to live. Have a blessed week.
And finally, from the Courier-Times, a well-known local radio personality passed away suddenly last Friday. Rob Hall, an employee at WKRX, WRXO for 30 years, passed away during a remote broadcast on Friday. Hall was 57 years old. He hosted several shows during his time at Radio Roxborough, including the Daily Want ads. It's hard to write a post, many of you have heard. Rob Hall has passed away this morning. He was such a big part of the radio station around since 1995 and has been a big part of our community and a great friend to many. We feel, as many others do, that we've lost a family member. Our hearts go out to Lisa and all of Rob's family. We've received many messages and calls, and they all send the Hall family their love. WKRX 96.7 Roxborough posted on its Facebook page. Hall's passing was mentioned during the Monday's meeting of the Person County Board of Commissioners. Person County has lost a great giant of a man at that open house in Rob Hall. I would like to remember his family in prayer as they lay him to rest, Commissioner Jason Thomas said. Since his passing, the Courier-Times has received emails and Facebook posts honoring Hall's memory. Person County has lost a true champion with the death of beloved radio personality Rob Hall, Corliss Green said. Rob loved Person County and its people. He was not a man who put on airs. He was a true country boy and proud of it. He was a kind-hearted man who never met a stranger. Rob will truly be missed. I always told him that his parents raised him right. I'm so grateful to have known him, and his legacy will live on. That's it for the Courier-Times. We'll go now to some articles from the Washington Daily News. Eric?
Key Women of America was founded in 1954 by Reverend Bertha Helms Harris in New York City to secure foster and adoptive homes for homeless children. As it evolved, it became involved with the prevention of drug addiction, hospital volunteer services, job development, prison visits, Big Sister prison release programs, programs for preschool children, and the awarding of scholarships. Washington native Emma Howard happened to be living in New York at the time and became a member of the organization. I admired Miss Bertha and the work she was doing, said Howard. She didn't have a college degree, but a college degree for life. She used to sell flowers in Manhattan. She was such a feisty lady. When Howard returned to Washington in 1992, and at the urging of the president of the national organization in New York, she began the process of establishing a charter in Washington. We had to have 10 members and a project before we could have a charter, said Howard. I went around and spoke at churches. I was a member of the Boys and Girls Club and the Beaufort County Partnership for Children, and I just started recruiting people to become members. Our first project was to work with the Boys and Girls Clubs, the River Trace and Ridgewood Manor Nursing Homes, and the Rainbow House, which was a group home for the mentally ill. And successful she was. With 22 members and projects in hand, the Washington branch was chartered on December 3rd, 1994, with Howard being pinned as the first president. The installation and charter ceremony were held at Mel's restaurant by the water. That day meant a lot to me, said Howard. It made me feel good that we were reaching out to the nursing homes, the Boys and Girls Clubs, and providing scholarships. When you reach out to help someone, you help yourself too. That's the key. Marion Booth was one of the charter members of the organization. In those early years, I was still working, and we had children in the school system, said Booth. I saw the opportunity for my children to receive scholarships, and they did, all four of them. It was a big help and a blessing, and to be able to do the same in return for others means a lot to me. Stephanie Walters, the newbie as she is called, joined the organization 8 years ago. I wanted to be a part of something as I felt the need to give back and help people, said Walters. So the mission itself is what really caught me. I had been working in special ed and have always had a heart for helping those in need. I knew the mission would make me a part of the community. And that work continues today. At Thanksgiving, they prepare food baskets and distribute them to those in need. At Christmas, they put together gift baskets and deliver them to nursing homes. They provide monetary donations to the Salvation Army, the Boys and Girls Club, and Beaufort County Partnership for Children. Provide educational services to youth by way of summer camps and field trips, and continue to visit the nursing homes and spend time with the patients, be it a friendly conversation or reading to them. To date, they have given out 69 scholarships, all things that have created a lifetime of memories. I have been inspired by the holiday gift-giving, said Walters. Just preparing the gift and food boxes and delivering them to the community gives me a good feeling. One thing that got me the most was when I delivered a food box to a home where one of the children answered the door. I told him to give it to his mama when she got home. He was so excited and yelled, "We got food!" It broke my heart to see the feeling he got from having received some food. It really touched me. The youth development and education have meant a lot to me over the years, added Booth. Being able to present scholarships to students in dire need has been special for me, and in some cases those students have been from a single-family home. The excitement on their faces really impacts me. And for Howard, it has been all about the good feeling one gets when helping others. We have helped those who have been burned out of their homes. I've gone to hospitals and nursing homes and read verses to them. A lot of these folks in nursing homes don't even have family come and see them, so to see that smile on their face makes you feel very good. And at 94, Howard doesn't plan on stopping anytime soon. As an organization, we have never stopped, and we will continue, said Howard. When I'm dead and gone, the young ones will come in and take over, she exclaimed with a very big smile.
Well, Aurora area residents gathered at 12:15 p.m. on Friday, June 6th, at S.W. Snowden Elementary School to give students a final send-off. Students who attended Snowden this year are the last students to ever walk its hallways. On Tuesday, June 3rd, the Beaufort County Board of Education voted 6-3 to permanently close the school due to decreasing student population and lack of essential funding. Students, depending on their grade level, will either attend Chocowinity Primary or Chocowinity Middle School. Students have the option to attend another school within Beaufort County if space is available, a private or charter school, or attend a school in Pamlico County. Students who move to Chocowinity Primary or Middle will not have to register, according to Beaufort County Schools.
A Washington woman was found dead by police officers when they conducted a welfare check at approximately 12 p.m. on Saturday, June 7. Police located Joanna Masters, 54, at 606 McNair Street. Welfare checks, also known as wellness checks, are performed by law enforcement officers when there are concerns about a person's safety or health. Police are investigating Masters' death. Anyone with information is encouraged to contact Washington Police Department at 252-946-1444 or leave an anonymous tip with the Beaufort County Crime Stoppers at 252-975-6400.
And now we'll go to the Kinston Free Press, and the Lenoir County Public Schools Class of 2025 was celebrated in five graduation ceremonies during the past month, culminating Saturday with nearly 600 students receiving diplomas from South Lenoir High School, Kinston High, and North Lenoir High. Earlier ceremonies were held for the 11 graduates of Lenoir County Learning Academy on Friday and for the 53 seniors of Lenoir County Early College High School in May. Together, the district's 621 graduates earned more than $33 million in scholarships, a $10 million increase over last year, and a new district record for the fifth consecutive year. "This is an extraordinary class," said LCPS Superintendent Brent Williams. "What these students have accomplished academically, personally, and as leaders is inspiring. We are so proud of their achievements, and we are confident they will continue to represent LCPS with distinction." At South Lenoir High, Principal Elizabeth Pierce expressed her gratitude and admiration for her graduates, who were offered more than $11.8 million in scholarships. "As you move forward, remember that success isn't defined by perfection, but by persistence," Pierce said. "Be kind and stay curious. Keep learning." South Lenoir High School graduate Tanner Dawson reflected on his class's deep roots and bright future. "South Lenoir has always been home," Dawson said. The school helped us grow into who we are, and it gave us a family. As we move on, we'll carry these lessons with us, always proud to be Blue Devils.
Okay, this is a rather long article about the City of Kinston's budget. So I'm going to read about a little overview and then about the public hearing, because you can go on to their website to get the budget details.
Yeah, Mayor, we probably need to edit it pretty severely because we are running out of
time. Oh, okay. Yeah, in that case, yeah. That's good. Okay. Kinston City Council held a public hearing on the budget on June 3rd that drew opposition from five people, including one resident who said that property tax bills are becoming unaffordable and may force people to leave the city. Several residents spoke in opposition of the city's property tax rate only being reduced from 75 cents to 73 cents per $100 in property valuation in Kinston's proposed 25-26 budget. Councilman Chris Suggs and Councilwoman Felicia Solomon were absent from the hearing. The proposed property tax of 73 cents per 100 valuation will be discussed further by council prior to the budget adoption. The council is expected to vote on the budget on June 17th, and the $133 million fiscal 25-26 budget would go into effect on July 1st. The budget is nearly $13 million more than the current fiscal 24-25 budget of $128 million, said Rhonda Barwick, the Kinston City Council, city manager, rather. With 2025 being Lenoir County property tax reevaluation year, the city has a revenue neutral rate, which is calculation used to determine tax rate needed to generate the same amount of revenue after a property reevaluation, ensuring that the overall tax burden remains constant, according to Coates Canons NC local government law. Barwick said the city's revenue neutral property tax is around 59 cents per $100 in property evaluation. Barwick said the budget recommends a reduction from 77 to 73, 14 cents higher than in the revenue neutral rate, and this change will result in property owners paying more in taxes. Property owners whose properties also increase in value will pay more in taxes in the upcoming fiscal year. And I'll just tell you that the budget is now available for review through the city's website, or you can go to the city clerk's office and at the Noose Regional Library at 510 North Queen Street in Barwick. North Queen Street, according to Barwick. They're going to vote on the budget on June 17th. So I'm going to stop it there, because if you want to know about all the budget details, you can go to that website.
Yep, sorry we had to edit that.
Yeah,
so severely,
but it's very, very long.
It's pretty lengthy, and
yep.
we're running. It's, the clock just moves faster than
it should. Oh, yeah, it looks like it jumped.
I know. Okay, some articles from the Jacksonville Daily News. The Jacksonville City Council received a recent update on the city's housing policy that involves assistance that can be provided more housing opportunities for area residents. Tracy Jackson, director of Jacksonville Neighborhood Improvement Services, said U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development guidelines were raised on April 1. The average current rental rate for a two-bedroom in the city of Jacksonville is $1,300 a month, Jackson said. Realistically, a person shouldn't spend more than 30% of their income on rent, but with what the area median income is, more people are paying more in monthly rental costs. For example, a teacher who makes around $41,000 a year shouldn't be paying more than $860 a month in rent, Jackson said. Similarly, a Marine Corps-based Camp Lejeune mechanic who makes around $46,000 a year should pay no more than $1,030 a month in rent. Because of the lack of affordable housing in the area, Jackson said many people are able to get assistance with the city's program. Currently in the Community Development Block Grant Program, Jackson said there are five buildable lots, four of which will be developed for affordable housing. There are also three affordable homes for sale and two homes at 408 and 410 Ann Street that are currently being built and will be available in about 60 days, Jackson said. If you think you qualify, or if you know someone who can qualify, make sure they contact us, and we'll show you how to get into these homes, she said. Gerald Blackman, Jacksonville's assistant city manager, said the city has already been working with Carolina Statewide Development and East Carolina Community Development on several projects. There are also future public-private partnerships being discussed that include transitional housing, land acquisition, and infill redevelopment. For example, the vacant Red Carpet Inn at 701 North Marine Boulevard is being eyed as a transitional housing site by the United Way of Onslow County and other partners. That's not an easy project to take on, Blackman said. The local realtor association has been engaged with that project. They've actually brought in a team that's been doing some interviews. Our role shouldn't be real estate developers, but we should be the ones that are out there helping to facilitate or make sure that all of our citizens have an opportunity to safe and decent housing, whether it's rental or homeownership. Jackson said most recent homeless count for the city of Jacksonville, which was completed in January, was about 140 people, but they believe the number is higher.
A Louisiana native and Marine Corps veteran who's made Onslow County her home is preparing to open a mobile bar business in the summer. Crystal Dunaway was born and raised in Louisiana and served 10 years in the U.S. Marine Corps before settling in Camp Lejeune. Once I got out, I was kind of like, what am I supposed to do? She said. I had these broken shoulders and I wasn't serving anymore. And I'm like, I need to do something for myself. I'm bored and I really need to find a purpose. That's when Dunaway said she began hiking in the name of suicide prevention with Irreverent Warriors, a cause close to her heart, and began to taking night classes to become a licensed expert mixologist. She's now an alcohol beverage control certified bartender set to open Dway's Tipsy Trailer, a mobile bar business, in July. I started looking for an investment, and I saw the trailer, and I'm like, there is absolutely no business like this around here in Jacksonville, North Carolina, Dunaway said. I haven't seen one, and the one that's closest to us is about 4 hours away, so I think I have something here. After buying the trailer, Dunaway said an associate of hers suggested she apply to Pitch It Onslow. Pitch It Onslow, in its fourth year, is a competition that allows potential business owners to pitch their ideas to a panel of business bulldogs for a chance to win startup money. It's a partnership between Coastal Carolina Community College, Marine Federal Credit Union, and the Jacksonville Onslow Chamber of Commerce, and has often been compared to the television show Shark Tank. Dunaway's business, Dway's Tipsy Trailer, was selected as one of 16 businesses to enter the competition, which included 8 weeks of entrepreneurship training. It was an amazing eye-opener, Dunaway said. I had somebody ask me, would I refer anybody to the class or would I encourage people to go? I said yes, and I said no. I said yes because of what you will learn in this class, the ins and outs, what you need, the legalities, the business plan, every single thing down to the tablecloth and the mood of the room. I said no because when you go to this class, you really have to be serious. But Dunaway was serious about her new venture. She was chosen to submit her pitch deck, and she pitched Dway's Tipsy Trailer in front of the business bulldogs, which included Synergy Innovative Solutions owner and Chief Executive Officer Lashea Cavers, Marine Federal Credit Union Chief Operations Officer Ryan Likens, and CCCC Continuing Education Division Chair Ashley Gernganis. Dway's Tipsy Trailer ultimately took second place in the competition, earning a $4,500 prize. Not only does Dunaway plan to open the mobile bar, but she is also having a custom satellite bar made. My goal is to do weddings and corporate events, but I don't want to count it out like if you're having a Super Bowl party and it's just 30 of your homeboys. That's where my satellite bar comes in. It's really a luxury experience. Dunaway said her Tipsy Trailer setup includes a sitting area, hydration station, and hand washing station. She also plans to only hire women bartenders. The business slogan is Sip Happens. I'm looking forward to this journey, she said. This is going to be a lot of fun. I told myself in 2 years I would have a satellite bar, and I'm actually doing it within 2 months. She held her first event, a soft opening, on base earlier this month and plans to hold a grand opening out front of Blackbird's Triple Play Restaurant at 302 Western Boulevard in Jacksonville on July 19th at 6 p.m. The goal is to have my trailer and my whole setup and satellite bar out there as well so you can see what I have. For more information about Dway's Tipsy Trailer, reach out to Dway's Tipsy Trailer 25@gmail.com.
A pause of war in eastern North Carolina has been awarded the Military Officers of America Association's Community Outreach Grant for the third consecutive year. Paws of War is a nonprofit with a goal to rescue dogs from shelters and match them with disabled veterans and first responders to then be trained as companion or service dogs. MOAA's Community Outreach Grant provides assistance to local uniformed service members, veterans, and their families to improve their quality of life, according to Mark Sanvigan, the MOAA Coastal Carolina chapter. MOAA Coastal Carolina partners with the Paws of War ENC program to assist veterans, active duty service members, and first responders in selecting, training, and certifying their dogs as companion, therapy, or service dogs. The program works with local shelters, law enforcement canine units, and veterinarians to help place the right dog with the right service member, essentially creating a team. Once the team is established, they work to pursue specific training needed to assist with combat injuries or other health issues. Training lasts up to 18 to 24 months, Sandovan said. Paws of War, ENC, has worked closely with local businesses, veterans halls, and business owners across eastern North Carolina to provide a variety of environments dogs need to become useful companions. The Community Outreach Grant was awarded in the amount of $3,500. The grant in years past has assisted in providing reimbursement for the trainers who travel from Winterville to Swansboro. The grant also provides the specialized gear needed to ensure mobility for those who need it during training. The partnership between MOAA Coastal Carolina Chapter and Paws of War ENC ensures the continued success of the program, Sandovan said. He said the program's success is measured through their ability to train more trainers, pay administrative costs, and reduce the time on the waiting list for those who wish to be a part of the program. To date, the grant has helped close to 100 owner dog teams pass basic obedience training, with 30 going on to achieve American Kennel Club, Canine Good Citizen certifications, and for some state and federal certifications as registered service dogs.
Infant of Prague Catholic School held its first ever high school graduation Friday morning during a graduation mass that saw two seniors receive their diplomas. The mass and baccalaureate service took place at 9 a.m. at Infant of Prague Catholic Church in Jacksonville. Sophia Ezit and Chanel Rendon Hoare are the first to graduate from Infant of Prague Catholic School's High School, which opened in August 2023 after an increase in enrollment led to the need for not only a new upper campus, but also a high school curriculum. IOPCS first opened it in the 1950s and offered education through the eighth grade prior to adding high school in 2023. Today, we gather not only to celebrate two exceptional young women who are crossing the threshold into a new chapter of life, but also to honor the journey of the school that for many years existed only in a dream, said Principal Angelica Bernal. Bernal told Ezit and Rendon Hoare that they'll always be the first to wear the cap and gown and the first to be honored as IOPCS High School alumni. May you always carry with you school values of compassion, honesty, reverence, integrity, service, and trust that were nurtured here at IOP Catholic School, she said. Both graduates, alongside their diplomas, were presented gifts from the Catholic Daughters of America, and Ezit was awarded a $500 scholarship from the Knights of Columbus. In her graduate address, Ezit thanks her teachers and coaches, but also thanked her parents and the sacrifices they made, including her father, a veteran. She spoke about how grateful she was for the education and experience that the school gave her, including getting the chance to play for the school's first girls' soccer team. I grew up in this church, Ezit said, so to be able to go here my entire life as a parishioner and now graduate from high school, I couldn't have asked for anything more. Rendon Hare also thanked her teachers and family and thanked her parents in Spanish. She said she's excited and sad to be graduating. The feeling you graduate is so surreal, she said. Sophia and I were actually discussing it. It feels like time stops or your heart stops. But Rendon Hare said she's looking forward to talking about her time at school with her future children. Both Izzet and Rendon Hare are headed to college in the fall. Izzet will be attending Belmont Academy College in Belmont to study nursing, and Rendon Hare will be attending Germana Community College in Virginia to pursue business and entrepreneurship. Looking at our upper campus students, the only advice I could think to give you is stick with it, Izzet said. Don't give up. Don't let the difficult times at school distract you from the end goal, and trust me, there will be difficult times.
And that's it from the Jacksonville Daily News. We go down to the Triad and some articles from the Greensboro News and Record. Family members and friends of inmates in North Carolina jails and prison, including Forsyth County, are being targeted by a phone scam that offers an earlier release from their sentence for a bond payment. The State Insurance Department says they're working with law enforcement agencies on at least 20 separate fraud cases involving the scam. Among the counties where the scam has been attempted are Alamance, Buncombe, Cleveland, Gaston, Haywood, Iredell, Johnston, Lincoln, Mecklenburg, Union, and Wake counties. The scam involves an impersonator calling the family member or friend of an inmate and demanding they pay a percentage of bond by a cell phone app, such as Chime, Apple Pay, or Venmo, to secure the early release. Once the scammer receives the money, they do not bail out the inmate. Instead, they make off with the money and refuse to answer phone calls or texts from the family member. Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey said Monday the scam appears to have originated in Georgia. We've seen several different variations of this scam where those in jail obtained a cell phone either through another person or by a drone drop-off, Causey said. We're asking the public to be aware of this scam and never send money to a bail bondsman over the phone without checking with the Department of Insurance first. Causey said impersonating a bail bond agent is a crime, as well as impersonating a law enforcement office. Be wary of unsolicited phone calls from someone claiming to be a bail bond agent, Clausey said. Don't bow to these pressure tactics, such as someone telling you it's urgent to get the payment in immediately. Always check to make sure you're dealing with a licensed bail bond agent. To report a bail bond scam, you can call the department at 919-807-6840 or 888-680-7684. Or for more information, you can go to the Department of Insurance website, ncdoi.gov.
In 2022, Second Harvest Food Bank of Northwest North Carolina and our network of 332 partner food pantries served an average of 35,300 people each month, children, seniors, veterans, and working families. Today, that number has more than doubled. From late 2023 through May of this year, we've assisted an average of 78,400 people every month. This isn't a spike, it's a sustained hunger crisis. And while we're doing all we can to meet this overwhelming need, Congress is on the verge of making our work nearly impossible. In recent weeks, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a budget bill that would slash $300 billion in food assistance, gutting the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP, eliminating SNAP Ed, SNAP's nutrition education component, and shifting billions in new costs to states. 11 of North Carolina's 15 House members voted in favor of this bill. Let's be clear, this decision would devastate North Carolina families, farmers, and local economies. SNAP, still often called food stamps, provides 9 meals for every 1 meal that food banks like Second Harvest can offer. With community support, we distributed nearly 40 million meals last year. If SNAP were cut by just 10%, we would need to provide 28 million more meals to fill the gap, jumping from 40 million to 68 million meals annually. That's not possible. Meanwhile, SNAP Ed, which provides practical evidence-based nutrition education to over 130,000 North Carolinians each year, is targeted for total elimination. This program helps families stretch food dollars and improve health outcomes. Every dollar invested in SNAP Ed can yield up to $9.54 in future health care savings. Supporters of the House bill claim these cuts are needed to reduce fraud or prevent able-bodied people who don't want to work from abusing the system. These are inflammatory distractions from reality. The truth is that most SNAP recipients are children, seniors, people with disabilities, and working families. And according to the Food Industry Association, most fraud is not committed by participants but by criminals exploiting outdated systems. Cutting benefits will not fix that. Modernizing the system will. SNAP is one of the most effective tools we have to improve health and economic stability. Children in SNAP households are more likely to graduate and grow up healthier. Older adults on SNAP are hospitalized less and stay independent longer. Families facing emergencies, medical job loss, or caregiving use SNAP to bridge the gap and recover. If enacted, the House's proposed changes would have far-reaching consequences. This is not just a policy decision, it's a moral and economic crossroads. Do we dismantle that works or do we choose to improve it? The House budget sets a course toward more hunger, weaker economies, and reduced opportunity for future generations. Within the next 2 weeks, the Senate will begin deliberations through a process called budget reconciliation, fast-tracking decisions that will shape our future. The stakes are high to stay silent. This is our moment to say North Carolina can do better. We must. Sounds like an editorial, but it wasn't.
Right.
It wasn't.
Well,
yeah.
Contact your senator.
Yeah.
It's important. Well, Matt Martineau has gone through his collection of framed photographs, articles, lineup cards, and other memories contained in the Grimsley High School classroom he's taught in for 18 of his 19 years at the school. One item stands out. Hanging on the wall is a framed photo of the soccer coach given to him by a former player's parent some 10 years ago. The photograph captures one of Martineau's many pregame talks, a last opportunity to get his players focused before kickoff. Taking an angle from the stands, the faces of each player are visible as they huddle up with the coach, a fixture on the campus who left a mark in both athletics and academics. Martineau has taught for 18 of his 19 years at Grimsley, but he's preparing to transition into retirement at the end of the school year. The next chapter is a mystery, however. I'm not sure what that is yet, so this might be a bit of a sabbatical, but it was just an opportunity, Martineau said. My wife retired a couple of years ago from Guilford County Schools as well, and she taught at Grimsley, so it was just time to do something different. Martineau first went to college with other intentions before finishing his career at Grimsley with a 212, 121, and 23 record. Add his 7 years at Northeast Guilford, and his career mark is 334, 205, and 43. He grew up in East Brunswick, New Jersey, a New York suburb located close to New Brunswick, where he was born. That's where he was first exposed to soccer. I had four older brothers that all played soccer, so basically I was taken to the games, and I just had to sit there, watch, and wait for those guys to finish up, and eventually it became a desire, he said. Really, for as long as I can remember, I wanted to have a ball at my feet playing through high school and then wanted to do something different, and I kind of stepped away from the game. While in middle school, Martineau moved with his family to Greensboro and eventually graduated from Western Guilford High School in 1988. From there, he attended NC State, studying architecture and engineering with the goal of building and design. However, being a tutor shifted his desire toward a different kind of construction, the formation of teams and minds. He would go on to earn a math degree from UNC Greensboro in 1996, along with a teaching certification. I enjoyed teaching, and I think that light bulb moment for students has always been a motivating force for me, he said. Seeing teaching and coaching in a similar light, Martineau began working at Northeast Guilford as a math teacher, while also being a three-season coach, doing boys soccer in the fall, junior varsity basketball in the winter, and girls soccer in the spring. He became the head boys soccer coach at Northeast in 1999. The three sports situation is how he met his wife, Christian, who at the time was a cheerleading coach at Northeast. They began dating in 1997, got married in 2000. They have two children, son Eric and daughter Elise. He stopped coaching basketball with the birth of Eric and dropped girls soccer when Elise arrived. The couple went to Grimsley in 2006. The kids went to Grimsley after attending Brooks Global and Kaiser Middle School. So it's been a huge part of our family to be in that community, he said. In 2005, his last season at Northeast, Martineau's team achieved the unheard-of accomplishment for the program, reaching the state semifinals. Then in 2007, he guided Grimsley to its first state championship game appearance since 1993, where it lost 3-2 in overtime to Raleigh's Broughton. In 2013, he was the West's head coach at NC Coaches Association East-West All-Star Game. For him, the biggest highlights of his career have been the team bus rides, the training sessions, and spending time with his players. Martineau said his coaching philosophy has been built on high expectations, not having excuses, and preparation for the workforce. My philosophy basically revolves around, it's time to grow up, take care of your own stuff, he said. You don't have to rely on someone else to hand you socks or shin guards or something if you're ready to play. And I want those guys, if they go to work, to have those same expectations. Martineau expressed gratitude for the Grimsley community and its significant impact on his life. Athletic director Evan Fancourt is just grateful to have had him as a coach. I think any coach's goal is to leave it better than they found it, and Coach Martineau certainly did that, Fancourt said. We're very grateful for his 19 years as the head boys soccer coach at Grimsley. Again, that's uncommon in today's coaching world. He runs an incredible program and has left it in a great spot for Mike Bear to be able to take over and continue to build and continue to grow and continue building one of the premier soccer programs in the state. It's a rare, incredible soccer coach and equally incredible in the classroom. His scores in AP statistics and calculus, he's an incredible math teacher, incredible coach, and has helped countless Grimsley students and athletes, Fancourt said. His combination of being able to help kids in the classroom and on the field is relatively unmatched.
While Chris Turner and a friend hiked the Appalachian Trail 3 years ago, they hatched a plan to hike Kilimanjaro, the highest peak in Africa. This might seem like an unusual topic of conversation on the trail. After all, Turner lost 40 pounds and 3 toenails, got caught in a nasty lightning storm, and averaged about 20 miles a day while hiking the 2,175-mile trail. My thoughts would have been more along the lines of spas and luxury hotels, but Turner lives for adventure. The AT spurred a love for big adventures. Turner, 26, reached eighth grade math at Jefferson Middle School and is the Young Life sponsor at Regan High School. Young Life is a non-denominational Christian ministry that reaches out to kids. Turner's love of the outdoors is evident in his classroom. On his desk is a photograph of him rafting the Gauley River in West Virginia, and a map of Yosemite National Park is tacked to the wall. Turner credits his time in Boone as a student of Appalachian State University with sparking his interest in the outdoors. Though he graduated in the spring of 2005, his love for Boone burns hot. God kissed the ground and called it Boone, he said. During summers, he started guiding raft trips through the Watauga River for Edge of the World Outfitters. It was great to be outside, tell jokes all day, and get paid for it, Turner said. I laughed from 9 in the morning to 6 in the evening. After graduation, Turner had some time to kill before hiking the Appalachian Trail, which was scheduled for the spring of 2006. So he headed west to Yosemite, where he worked at a number of jobs, from restaurant host to videographer to janitor, while living in a cabin at the park. Each morning, he awoke to a view of Half Dome, perhaps the park's most famous feature. The next spring, he and a friend hiked the Appalachian Trail, finishing in 4.5 months, which is about 2 weeks faster than most hikers. Before that, the most he had hiked in one day was 13 miles. With that adventure out of his system, Turner took a job at Jefferson Middle in 2007, a job he loves. When summer rolls around, he's off on another adventure. This past summer, he and a friend planned to bicycle from Barcelona, Spain to Rome, but while riding his bike in Winston-Salem, he had an accident and broke his right cheekbone and suffered a concussion. The bike trip was out, but the second leg of the trip, a hike to the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania, was still on. In August, he and his friends reached the summit, which is 19,340 feet above sea level. Why Kilimanjaro? Turner answered with a famous quote from legendary alpinist George Mallory, "Because it's there." The last day on the mountain, he and his party hiked for about 8 hours to a steep incline to reach the summit. "So what's next? India and South America sound interesting," he said. "That's living. Trips like that make me come alive, and I can't imagine sitting in a classroom or a cubicle every single day." Footnote: Great Outdoor Provision will have a slideshow series to celebrate Mountains to Sea Trail Month. First showing will be today from 7 to 8:30 at the Garage. It's free and will feature Mark Sinnott, a world-renowned climber. The second slideshow will be October 17th in the store at Thruway Shopping Center from 6:30 to 7:30. Bruce Wisely, a Mountains to Sea hiker, will talk about the trail, a 900-mile trail that runs the length of the state.
And that's it for the news and record. We'll go now to the Winston-Salem Journal. When one or both of Forsyth County's top two local law enforcement officers step to a microphone in a room filled with cameras, it's usually not going to be hosannas, puppies, or rainbows. Gunfire has rocked a school campus, a cop has been killed, or there's a small mountain of dope on the table. Something bad. Case in point, just a few weeks ago, Winston-Salem Police Chief William Penn stood in front of a similar gathering to announce a crackdown on teens and young adults running amok through downtown. Not the crime of the century, but not a good look. On Monday, Penn, Forsyth County Sheriff Bobby Kimbrough, and a host of adults working in or around the juvenile justice system filed into a small room at the sheriff's office carrying a distinctly different vibe, hope. "This is one of the few press conferences when I've been happy to come into this room," Kimbrough said. "Typically, it's gloom and doom. This time, the array of usual suspects wore smiles instead of scowls. Law enforcement, along with leaders in nonprofits and community groups working with vulnerable youth, decided to come out in force to back an innovative program that aims to, at a minimum, show a different way. Traditionally, we'd stay on our side of the field and let everybody else do the rest," Penn said, noting that at-risk youth are just as likely to be victims as offenders. "Doing this just to keep kids out of trouble is such a low bar." Monday's announcement is essentially a doubling of an initiative called STARS, Students Taking Action and Reaching Success, set to launch later this month. The idea is to take kids between 10 and 18, put them in a room for a half day every day for six weeks, and teach such life skills as anger management, financial literacy, and goal setting. Some 40 youths, boys and young men, will be paired with mentors and paid a modest $100 stipend. Their families will be involved as well. "When you give young people the chance to be heard and to be seen and be supported, they find their strength and resilience," said Valerie Glass, executive director of Triangle Restorative Justice, a nonprofit focusing on repairing relationships harmed by the effects of crime. "They step up and they start to build a better future for themselves. And it won't cost taxpayers a thin dime. The $35,000 price tag is being covered by nonprofits, the Sheriff's Foundation, and whatever private donations can be wrangled. The stipends," Kimbrough said, "it'll run about $6,000. "Don't get caught up in the cost," Kimbrough said. "It's a small price to pay for changing kids' lives." Will it work? Can a six-week summer program get one kid into a community college classroom instead of a courtroom? It's impossible to know. Concrete results won't be known for years. Even then, who knows what moment or moments led to which decision. Sometimes kids are who they have to be rather than who they want to be," Kimbrough said. Nobody used the word gang, but the implication was clear. Peer pressure can be ferocious. One other thing, less obvious but equally notable, was implicit in the presence of the sheriff and the police chief. Both men are local, both grew up in less privileged neighborhoods, and both fully realize their value as role models. "I could have been one of those kids," Kimbrough said. And Penn, closer to the end of his tenure as chief than the beginning, focused on the future. "We're not going to be here forever."
It was an unusual question coming from a police officer. Heather Brady was napping at home in San Francisco on a Sunday afternoon when the officer knocked on her door to ask, had she applied to Arizona Western College? She had not. And as the officer suspected, somebody else had applied to Arizona community colleges in her name to scam the government into paying out financial aid money. When she checked her student loan servicer account, Brady saw the scammers hadn't stopped there. A loan for over $9,000 had been paid out in her name, but to another person, for coursework at a California college. I just can't imagine how many people this is happening to that have no idea, Brady said. The rise of artificial intelligence and popularity of online classes have led to an explosion of financial aid fraud. Fake college enrollments have been surging as crime rings deploy ghost students, chatbots that join online classrooms and stay just long enough to collect a financial aid check. In some cases, professors discover almost no one in their class is real. Students get locked out of the classes they need to graduate as bots push courses over their enrollment limits, and victims of identity theft who discover loans fraudulently taken out in their names must go through months of calling colleges, the Federal Student Aid Office, and loan services to try to get the debt erased. On Friday, the U.S. Education Department introduced a temporary ruling requiring students to show colleges a government-issued ID to prove their identity. It will apply only to first-time applicants for federal student aid for the summer term, affecting some 125,000 borrowers. The agency said it is developing more advanced screening for the fall. The rate of fraud through stolen identities has reached a level that imperils the federal student aid program, the department said in its guidance to colleges. An Associated Press analyst of fraud reports obtained through a public record request shows California colleges in 2024 reported 1.2 million fraudulent applications, which resulted in 223,000 suspected fake enrollments. Other states are affected by the same problem, but with 116 community colleges, California is a particularly large target. Criminals stole at least $11.1 million in federal, state, and local financial aid from California community colleges last year that could not be recovered, according to the reports. Colleges typically receive a portion of the loans intended for tuition, with the balance going directly to students for other expenses. Community colleges are targeted in part because of their lower tuition means larger percentages of grants and loans go to borrowers. Scammers frequently use AI chatbots to carry out the fraud, targeting courses that are online and allow students to watch lectures and complete coursework on their own time. In January, Wayne Chaw started getting emails about a class he never signed up for at De Anza Community College, where he had taken coding lessons a decade earlier. Identity thefts have obtained his Social Security number and collected $1,395 in financial aid in his name. The energy management class required students to submit a homework assignment to prove they were real, but someone wrote submissions impersonating Chaw, likely using a chatbot. This person is typing as me, saying it's my first and last name. It's very freaky when I saw that. The fraud involved a grant, not loans, so Chaw himself did not lose money. He called the Social Security Administration to report the identity theft, but after 5 hours on hold, he never got through to a person. Criminal cases around the country offer a glimpse at the scheme's pervasiveness. In the past years, investigators indicted a man accused of leading a Texas fraud ring that used stolen identities to pursue $1.5 million in student aid. Another person in Texas pleaded guilty to using the names of prison inmates to apply for $650,000 in student aid at colleges across the South and Southwest. And a person in New York recently pleaded guilty to a $450,000 student aid scam that lasted for a decade. And there's a few more examples, but I think in the interest of time, I'll probably end it there. It's a problem, and I had no idea that they were able to do that.
I'm Leon Whitehead. Mayor Cirillo and I have been reading selections from the sports section of today's News and Observer, Chatham News and Record, Courier Times, Washington Daily News, Kinston Free Press, Jacksonville Daily, Greensboro News and Record, and Winston-Salem Journal. Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is available as a podcast after this broadcast by visiting our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's noon broadcast is generously underwritten by Christine and Greg Tenser. Coming up at 1:30, it's Money Matters, 2 o'clock Triangle Yesteryear, 2:30 Discover Magazine, 3 o'clock Reader's Digest. It's time now for Money Matters. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call, 919-832-5138. Have a great day.